Thanks. Well, first of all, I should say I was delighted by the invitation, and I should thank the organizers for that, of course. Now, you've just heard from Marc-Antoine all the wonders of the physics of oscillation modes in giants. So what I will do in my talk is to pick a few examples of seismic diagnostics that we are now starting to apply to giants with several aims. One is to get robust estimates of global parameters of giants, and the other one is to try to start at least testing the internal structure of these stars. So let me start with a very simple diagram, which is just an HR diagram showing a synthetic population, which is representative of stars observed by Corot or Kepler. And the only point I wanted to make here is that if you have a look at the region of G and K giants there, then you can see that that region is populated by stars, or let's say by models, which have, of course, a significantly different mass and ages, and still they will end up in, end up having basically similar, very similar photospheric properties. What you don't see from that picture is that the situation is even more complex, and in fact, the internal structure of such stars is completely different. We can have stars that are ascending the RGB and they're burning helium, hydrogen in the shell, and they have an electron degenerate core, but can also have at very similar luminosities and effective temperatures stars that are in their core helium burning phase. And by no matter how precise or accurate you can get photospheric properties of those stars, you cannot tell the difference. You cannot directly learn about the internal structure of these stars. And of course, the structure of giants is rather complicated. Here's just a very simple illustration of a model of low mass helium core helium burning star. And of course, all the assumptions and inputs that you put in your models, they will end up determining, for instance, the stratification of the sound speed in the acoustic cavity, or the behavior of the Brun-Weisalla frequency in the in the G-mode cavity. And of course, all this will determine and will influence your predictions on the oscillation spectrum. And in fact, when we realized last year that we had in our hands these innovative seismic constraints, we decided to organize a small workshop last year, about a year ago in Roma, where we asked a few experts in the field to review the state of the art of modeling and uncertainties that goes into the modeling of red giants. And we collected all these review papers in a book, which will be out soon, but you can also access most of the contributions on AstroPH. And the idea was to place this problem and open questions in the new context of these observational constraints. So you will find reviews about how uncertainties on the microphysics will propagate somehow on your to your predictions of evolution of giants, but also modeling on, as we also heard in this conference, uncertainties of modeling convection in the outer layers or mixing in the core helium burning phase, or the transport not only of chemicals but also of angular momentum in the radiative and convective regions, how that will affect the internal structure, hence how that will affect the frequencies of oscillation modes there. Of course, the key question is not only to understand how these ingredients and uncertainty will affect the predicted spectrum, but also, given an observed frequency spectrum, which is the information we can recover on the internal structure of those stars, and can we really get to a point where we can start testing the models? So what I will do here is just give you a few examples of seismic diagnostics that we are using now, thanks to this wonderful data from Corot and Kepler. The first one, which was introduced by Marc-Antoine, concerns the detection of an acoustic glitch inside the structure of a giant star. And the detection, the first detection was made last year on a star which was observed for about 6 months by Corot, and by looking at the variation of the large frequency separation, which was, in fact, here is really the large frequency separation computed by taking differences of frequencies of consecutive orders. And then you could see a clear periodic component there. And by determining the periodicity of that component, as Marc-Antoine recalled, you can get an estimate of the location of such a sharp feature in terms of the relative acoustic radius. And by comparing that to models, we could associate or interpret that sharp feature as due to this local dip in the gamma in the first adiabatic exponent, which is due to the second helium ionization in the envelope of such stars. Sorry? The frequencies of a model. Of a model, yeah. one model was not necessarily the best model, just to show what is the expected component there. Now, of course, as Marc-Antoine already recalled, that the situation is different from the Sun, and to some respect is simpler, the component that you would expect. Of course, we are limited to low degree modes. We are limited to a range of radial orders, as Jörn also pointed out, which is much smaller than in the Sun. But in the Sun, if you compute from the models, or you have a look at the observed values of the second differences, then you will have two components superposed there, one which is originated by the base of the convective, at the base of the convective zone, and the other one in the helium ionization zones. But in giants, at least in most giants, the situation is simpler because the base of the convective zone is located at basically at a negligible acoustic radius, so that will not show up as a periodic component in the second differences or in the large frequency separation. Of course, we are very excited about this detection because that opens possibly opens the possibility at least of checking whether we could determine or infer or put some constraints on the envelope helium abundance in these cool stars that you cannot get from by any other means. But with Corot, as you can see in this data, we are limited by the uncertainties on the frequencies, which are too large to allow us to put any strong constraints, I would say, on the amplitude of this component. With Kepler, of course, the situation is getting better and better. And these are preliminary results obtained by Benoit Mosser. And these are just a bunch of giants in the observed by Kepler. And again, I'm plotting the large frequency separation as a function that's new in the end. And what you can clearly see in most of these stars are these clear periodic components appearing there. So what we're doing now is try to run some Heron-Hound exercises with using different evolutionary codes and models to test whether we can get, or which are the conditions on the modeling point of view and also from the observational point of view that could lead us possibly to the determination of an envelope helium abundance. And our next move will be to try to look for these signatures, in fact, in stars belonging to clusters, where we have additional constraint, of course, before just picking one of these beautiful signal and just publishing a paper. We'd like to first to have a look on how robust our conclusion could be. Now, again, a very different seismic diagnostic is the average period spacing. And Marc-Antoine has already described quite in detail what the information that is carried by this observed quantity. And again, the very interesting thing is that you can use that to discriminate whether a star, especially low mass stars, of course, are ascending the RGB or are burning helium in the clump. And that was first shown in a paper led by Tim Bedzing, and then also we see those features in Corot data. And the first comparison with models, which is shown here, and you also have these black stars there, was to some extent, I would say, rather disappointing, as probably, as also Jörn had said before, because we couldn't see, at least at this stage, an obvious discrepancy between the models and the observations, but we need to get into a detailed comparison, of course. Now, this is just to show a more extended prediction of period spacings that we are now about to publish, and that is based on models computed with the atom code, which is developed in Roma by Paolo Ventura and Italo Mazzitelli. And now we are including also models of low mass stars and following the evolution through the flash. And what is an interesting, say, correlation that we found in the models is between the average period spacing and the mass of the helium core for models that are burning helium in their core. And that is particularly interesting for stars in the mass domain for solar metallicity between, say, 1.8 to 3 solar masses, where, in fact, the mass of the helium core for stars that begin to burn helium in the core depends directly on the mixing processes or extra mixing processes that you might have during the main sequence. So being able to determine that precisely, and also, and then I will come back in a minute to that, defining well what the period spacing is from the models and what we are actually observing will eventually or could lead us to a test of core mixing processes during the main sequence. But there are, of course, things that we need to, and more constraints that we need to have. First of all, the metallicity of those stars. Because otherwise you will not be able to say constraints directly on the extra mixing, but just on the size of the core. Then we also need to be able to determine the masses of that of those stars accurately. Because what we're looking for basically is a relation between the mass of the helium core and the mass of the star. And if we use the scaling relations to determine the mass, then we have to make sure that we can do that with an accuracy better than 10% to say anything meaningful about the extra mixing on the main sequence. And again, as I said, the other issue is that we need to be sure that we are comparing models with the same quantity from models and from the observations. And in that respect, there's a very nice work that Benoit Mousser and Marie-Jo Goupil are about to submit. And that concerns basically a parameterization or a simple modeling of the expected pattern of the period spacing in such a way that can lead to an inference basically on the asymptotic value, which is of course much more and it is much simpler to compare that with the theoretical one. Okay, yeah. Now let me get to a very different sort of seismic diagnostics, which were introduced several times during this conference. And those are based on the famous or infamous scaling relations of the large frequency separation, or an average value of the large frequency separation, and of nu max, which is the frequency corresponding to the maximum power of solar-like oscillations. And if you assume these two scaling relations, then you are, say, brave enough, you can derive independently an estimate for radius and mass. And the key point here is to try to test the accuracy of these scalings. And that's not easy. You need independent measurements of radii and masses. Radii we can get. We have a bunch of stars. We can do that. For masses, we need eclipsing binaries or stars in the cluster. So I will just show you some examples of tests that we are running now. This is, well, a comparison between the radius of stars obtained with the scaling relations with the radius obtained either by using interferometric angular radii and a parallax from Hipparcos, and these are the red crosses, or by using basically effective temperature and bolometric flux and the parallax. And these stars are nearby dwarfs and a few giants there, which were observed from ground-based campaigns or by Corot. Most of these blue crosses here are Corot targets. And you see that the correlation is quite, well, it's quite nice, of course, but before you complain about me showing plots in log-log, let me show you the difference, the relative difference in radius, which is still very, it's remarkable. Even though we don't understand completely the scaling relation, especially the numax, these seem to work quite well, and you have a scatter which is about 5%. Of course, we need to populate that region, especially those for giants. But so far, at least as far as radius is concerned, the scaling seem to work quite well. Another obvious place where you can test or try to test the scaling relations are giants in the clusters, which are observed by Kepler. And in particular, in one cluster for NGC 6791, we have an independent estimate of the distance based on the radii of eclipsing binaries, which is to a large extent model independent. And so what we've done in a paper was to check, to compare again radii determined using the scaling relations with the radius obtained assuming a distance modulus and, well, the apparent magnitude and effective temperatures. And again, as you see, the agreement is quite remarkable there, and for most stars, the agreement is better than 5%. In that paper, we are also we could also show, in fact, that there's a need for a relative correction of the delta nu scaling relation when you are dealing with both a clump and RGB stars. That's supported with the models, but we've shown that also with data. So we have to be careful. Of course, a bias that's for clump star, a bias of two percent. In that scaling will mean a bias of about 4%, 5% in the radius. So we still we always have to keep that in mind. Now, if we assume these scalings, then the obvious thing that you can do for Corot stars in the exofield and then for Kepler giants is to compute some to estimate distances. And you do that in a very obvious way. You can have an estimate of the linear radius, then an effective temperature from photometry or spectroscopy. You can compute the absolute luminosity, and then by combining that with apparent magnitude that you need to be random, of course, then you can get distances with uncertainties which are of about 10-15%. Thanks. Now you can amuse yourself and compute distances for thousands of stars now. This is just an example showing the position on the, well, projected well, the position projected on the galactic plane of stars in the first two Koro long runs and Kepler public giants. And again, another plot showing the position of this Koro star in another plane. You can see that this population here is located on average farther below the plane than in LRA01, and I would come back to that in a minute. Then you can take also a step further and plot distributions of radii and masses for those populations, and that's just the first comparison. Take that with a pinch of salt. In the upper panel, I'm just showing the distribution of radii and masses as determined from the scaling relation for the two different populations, and here below are the distribution predicted by population synthesis software that parameterizes basically the properties of the galaxy and if you have a look at the comparison between the radii, well, you see that you don't see really a significant difference between these two populations, and also you can recover quite nicely this very isolated peak at 10, 11 solar radii, which is the radius of clump stars. Then when it comes to the mass, you see a difference between the average mass of stars in LRC01 compared to to those in LRA01. That's significant because we have hundreds of targets in these distributions. And interestingly enough, that's also what is shown by these models. And again, take that with a pinch of salt, but what this may be telling us is that, in fact, we are measuring, or at least we are seeing qualitatively for now, the vertical mass gradient, which is in the end the vertical age gradient in the disk of the galaxy. And that, of course, would be very important to inform studies about the chemical, and also once you provide also spectroscopic constraints, chemical and kinematical evolution of the galactic disk. Now, of course, what we would like to get for these stars in the end are ages. And giants, once you have the mass as a constraint, they become very, I would say, precise age indicators. And that that's obvious, but you see that in this plot. And the reason for that is just that for most of the giants, the age that they have during that phase is, for first approximation, the duration of the main sequence, which at the zero order depend on the mass of the star. So if you can access the mass of giants, then you can use it to determine ages. Things are not so simple, of course. You need to have an estimate of a metallicity, and you also have mass loss, which is complicating the picture for clump stars. But again, here comes one of the reasons why determining the evolutionary state for giants is so important. Because if you put yourself in a, say, worst case scenario, you have a star of that you estimate having, say, 10 solar radii and a mass of 1.1 solar mass, say, then you have a degeneracy, of course. And if you assume that you know the metallicity, effective temperature, nu max, delta nu, and then you can play and see what difference does it make of knowing or not the evolutionary state. Just to give you an example, here is just a simulation. What I'm plotting here is the posterior probability density function of age determined using a code which is called param, which was used in several studies of stellar populations. And here, well, the only thing that I like to that I want to point out is that put yourself in a case where you don't know the evolutionary state of that star, then the probability density, well, the posterior PDF for the age will be in fact bimodal, because you don't know if the star is in fact on the RGB or on the clump. You don't know the mass of the progenitor of the star. But if you can discriminate between RGB and clump stars, then you see that you can get to a much more precise age determination. So we are getting there, but of course we need more constraints, and especially spectroscopic constraints to fully exploit this data. Okay, yeah, let me just sum up. The idea of my talk was just to show you a few examples of seismic diagnostics that we are now applying to giants. And on one hand, you can get estimates of global parameters for these stars, which are very interesting because you can determine distances for those stars. And also the other, probably even more interesting to some respects, thing that we are starting to do is to get constraints on the internal structure for those stars. The first comparison, I've not yet shown a clear discrepancy between the models and the observations, but I'm quite optimistic we will get there. But, well, what we need are the boring constraints, as Luca explained the other day. We need effective temperatures and metallicity for those stars. But we also need Kepler to keep observing these stars, as we discussed. We need to access the more G modes to hope to be testing signatures of internal mixing in giants and all. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Andrea. So, comments, questions? Okay.
Just a comment on the helium abundances. There are two things that should make it a bit easier and less uncertain, the helium abundance from giants compared to the sun. First of all, the equation of state is much better known in those lower densities you have in red giant envelopes, whereas in the sun, the second ionization zone of helium is located where you have the most extreme, close to where you have the most extreme plasma conditions. And secondly, you also have the first ionization of helium, which is separated from the hydrogen ionization. So you have two features actually to fit.
Yeah, of course. When you, if I go back to that plot, you clearly see, as you mentioned, the that where there or the other one, you also see what's the first helium ionization zone there, which will also play a role. So it also comes to a point where you should be careful if you just fit your large separation with, say, an analytical analytical approximation of that component. You're maybe not using the correct one. So at some point, if it gets too complicated, of course, there are different schools of thought on that, but if it gets very complicated, you can also start comparing frequencies directly. And that the analytical approximation will guide you, but it's not. You can also start comparing frequencies directly.
Could you just go back to the plot of the data for the red giant? The one case, the core case that you, yeah, this yeah. One. I'm a bit intrigued by the error bars because the data actually show very nice and regular variation that's much better defined, it seems, than the error bars that you're providing for those data. So have the error bars been overestimated or?
Then we should ask Fabien Carrier who did that. But these are 6 months data. So what you can expect is probably an uncertainty of about 0.1 microhertz.
Correlated.
Pardon?
Okay. Just before you, we get back to that, let me just make the comments on a totally different point, namely the new max relation. I would claim we don't have the foggiest idea why it works, but it does work. So,
yeah.
So we really need to understand the physics of the determining the frequency at the maximum power much, much better to see why it works.
I agree.
Yeah, so on this plot, yes, the errors are correlated because you're measuring differences. And on the previous plot, people even measure second differences. So as an observer, can I make a plea where possible to use the actual frequencies? Numerical differentiation correlates and messes up all the error bars and makes correlations. There's no reason, I think, not to actually take the raw frequencies and fit to those instead.
Yeah, and that is something we're testing now for Kepler data, which is the most robust way of extracting that component. So using frequencies or combinations and also.
I would
take that into account. Thanks.
The reason for using second differences, Tim, or even something more complicated than that, is to remove combinations of frequencies that you've very well observed accurately that don't relate to what you're looking for. And it's very important to try to separate different aspects of the structure of a star as seen in diagnostics. So the purpose of doing that is to construct a diagnostic. And looking at second differences is not the best way of doing it, in my opinion. There are better ways than that. But looking at second differences is better than the raw frequencies because the raw frequencies are so heavily contaminated by other things, if you're looking for something in particular. And here we were looking for helium abundance rather than, say, the radius of the star.
Yes, I agree with your statement. If you have the raw frequencies, then you subtract, for example, just a slowly varying function to remove the slow variations, and then what's left are the wiggles you're interested in. And that's, I think, a more elegant way of doing it than measuring the slopes.
One of the problems is also, if I can.
I know Jérôme Bello's work.
What you should do is to have a model of the raw frequencies and fit that, which is what some of us do. But some people that say they're stupid observers, and I don't believe them, at least I don't believe that they're stupid, they want to do something that's simple. And I don't understand that, because they spend so much time, complicated time, making observations and then reducing the observations, that why on earth they don't spend a little bit of intellectual effort in analyzing the data more sensibly is something that I've never been able to understand. And perhaps you might explain it to me in private.
No comment.
Something totally different. Could you go back to the schematic picture of the Red Giant, one of your first slides, I believe? I just have a general comment that if you cut off your star somewhere in the blue shell, what you actually are left over is an SDB star. And yesterday we were talking about mixing processes at the edge of the convective core of an SDB star. And I think maybe the SDB community and the Red Giant community should compare some results there.
Yeah, indeed, yeah.
So anticipating my talk on Friday, I just want to say that we are hoping to get through the Apogee spectrograph, 300 fiber infrared spectrograph, spectra for as many astroseismic Kepler targets as possible. And hopefully, after getting the spectra, we can do things like get spectroscopic constraints on metallicity and temperature in combination with iterations with the astroseismic constraints. So I'll talk more about that on Friday, or you can talk to me or Mark along.
Okay, more questions? We still have time for one or two more questions. No? Everybody wants to go to the beach now, I guess, for the picnic. So thanks again, Andrea. And thanks to all the speakers of this morning session.